And now, from the gay capital of the Western Hemisphere, KSAN San Francisco presents The Gay Life. Hi, I'm Randy Alfred. This morning, we'll talk to Les Morgan about gay police recruitment, to Roland Scambari of Coming Up, the new gay calendar, and we'll have a report from the National March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights. But first, Linda Tillery performs Mary Watkins' Don't Pray for Me.
Life's passing you by while rules enslave you, and it's your blind innocence that traps you, that makes you think it's so wrong I do. Yeah, well, don't you know that you're a victim, a sweet Christian lady for reaching hate.
Don't pray for me, you've been telling my mind.
The National March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights was held on October 14th. On the KSAN talkies that morning, Joanne Rosenzweig spoke to reporter Barbara Fisher in Washington.
It's a beautiful day here in Washington, Joanne. We've had nothing but rain and snow, as you know, in the Baltimore, Washington area, but today is beautiful. I don't know if the press or other people in Washington are with us, but the weather sure is.
So what happens? The Orioles and the Pirates leave and the sun comes out?
That's about the way it happens. All the gay people come in and the lesbians. And
they've come out to her. What is going to be happening today? For some reason, it's gotten very little press out here on the West Coast, the march. I mean, we heard plenty about it last year, but in the last few weeks, there's been very little in the papers about it.
Okay, let me just address that first before I tell you exactly what seems to be happening here today. There seems to be very little press coverage here. I checked through both the Washington Post this morning and the New York Times, and unless there's big articles in the business and finance sections of those papers, there is absolutely nothing in any way of, you know, really covering. There's a very small article in the Washington Post which basically says it's happening and sort of outlines what's going on, but there's no real background stories in the Post today. The TV, also radio, has no talk shows covering it. To be fair, TV, I did watch this morning a show that covered it adequately. It was a wonderful show. I talked yesterday, a couple days ago, to Brandy Moore, who's the national media coordinator. He said the press has not been helpful at all, and they won't come to the main headquarters for information. And in fact, they've been spreading rumors like that the march is unorganized and that the march is being run by communists. And the most absurd one that he mentioned to me was that Adolf Coors is financing the march. Everyone knows Adolf Coors is the Coors Beer Company. And
Adolf Coors seems to have plenty to do these days, capitalizing on the fact that there aren't any nitrosamines in his beer. Giving away 3 packs for $1, 3 6-packs, I saw a big sign. Well, this is very interesting because have the coordinators, the media coordinators of the march, held press conferences that press people didn't attend, or what?
That's something I need to check out a little further. I have been watching the TV news pretty closely, and I did see Brandy Moore was on the TV show today. He was also on the news Friday evening. As to why there aren't any major articles, that I can try to check out a little further. Not real sure, but you have to remember that Washington is used to this sort of thing. A friend of mine who went to the anti-nuclear rally, I guess it was May 6th here, said she was impressed by the fact that there are 100,000 people here for that, and 3 streets away, local Washingtonians had no idea what was going on. So that's kind of what we're dealing with. And so I would like to stress that media coverage of this event is essential to get the message across.
What is going to be happening today, Barbara?
Okay, what's going to be happening, people are gathering, people are walking by me right now. I'm in about 6th in Pennsylvania. People are gathering down by the mall, and they'll be walking from the Capitol end of the mall down to the Washington Monument. And that'll be happening, it should be getting started right about now, and they'll be walking for a couple of hours. At 2 o'clock, there'll be a rally at the Washington Monument end of the mall, and they're going to be speeches there. And there's going to be Harry Britt is speaking. The little article in the Post says that some things will be happening. Eleanor Schmiel apparently is speaking.
She's the president of the National Organization for Women, just recently elected to another 2-year term.
Right, and D.C. Mayor Marion Barry was supposed to be the lead speaker, but apparently he's vacationing in Hawaii, and I'm told that Maria Diaz, lesbian and gay community liaison, will be giving that speech for him, but apparently he's in support. And I had asked, you know, what was the response of the police and things like that, and apparently the police are being very helpful, and the police were estimating about 20,000 as opposed to gay leaders who were estimating 100,000. And apparently, since people have been flooding in here for the last 2 days, and police apparently have upped their estimate. I don't know what they're estimating now. But people, it's amazing. People have been flooding in. Last night, a lot of things went on. There was a dance lesbian dance at the Shoreham Hotel, which is a pretty swanky hotel here in Washington. That happened. There was, at 6 o'clock last night, down here by the mall, there was a concert. Mae Christian was there, Holly Mear, Robin Tyler. Flo Kennedy gave a speech at that time. She gave her usual kick-ass speech. And so what's going to be happening mainly, Brandy Moore told me, that mainly they're going to be stressing human rights. This is a civil rights activity. And mainly they're going to be stressing immigration policies, reference to Carl Hill, which San Franciscans are used to hearing about that case, prison rights, and basically it's a human rights march. And that's what they're going to stress, human rights for this planet. And I sort of made an offhand reference to, too bad this wasn't happening last week. As you all remember, the Pope was in town last week. And we laughed about that. And then he told me, he said that basically the coordinators are trying not to stress any harassment of any particular figure, such as the Pope, and particularly Anita Bryant. He said that Anita Bryant has gotten enough coverage off of this.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's Barbara Fisher, live on KSAN from Washington, D.C.
That was last Sunday, October 14th. This morning, our first guest is a participant in the march. John Joyner is the editor of Alice Reports, the newsletter of the Alice B. Toklas Memorial Democratic Club in San Francisco, and also a very active member of the Harvey Milk Gay Democratic Club. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
What was the march like for you?
It was really fantastic. You know, I've been to several city hall marches here in San Francisco, and though the numbers weren't as great in Washington, to be able to look out over the group and see Texas and Illinois and South Carolina, all of the states represented, and sizable conventions from most of the states, it was really exciting to be able to witness the first coming together of gays from all over the country with a specific purpose in mind. And I went away with a really good feeling, and I still have that feeling.
So you were more impressed with the diversity than with the overall numbers?
Oh, yeah, I think it was the diversity. You know, the numbers, if I get into that, there were somewhere around 75 to 100,000, and I think that's a respectable number. There were some people who were hoping for more, and we didn't get it. But I think 100,000 people who were willing to pay their way to Washington, D.C. for one weekend is a significant number, and I'm pleased with the number, too.
Were there any special moments in the march for you as it started, as it reached some goal, all of those symbols of power in Washington?
There was a couple of places. Very early, I think there's something that was symbolic, not of Washington, but of San Francisco and San Francisco's gay community, was that as we were forming in the plaza, we would pass by different delegations as we were doing our march to get in line, and we passed by the state delegation from Tennessee, and all of a sudden we heard, "Hip, hip, hooray," and we looked over, and they had a sign, and it said, "Thank you, San Francisco. Thank you for everything you've done. We love you." And then they had three cheers for San Francisco, and it really brought home to me that we are the cutting edge. We are the forefront of this. And people all over this country are looking to us to learn from our mistakes in the battles that we've won and hopefully avert some of those mistakes. And I really, that was...
Hopefully learn from some of the successes as well.
Sure, sure. As far as symbols of power, I guess the thing I enjoyed most was when the Harvey Milk Gay Democratic Club got in front of the White House. We stopped, we held the banner up, and all of us that were from Harvey Milk, was available at the time, stood there with Harry, and everybody took pictures. There must have been 150 photographers taking pictures of this one event. And we turned around and we realized that we were here. We had made it. This was the goal, and the man that sat in that office was the person that we had to get the message to. And I think we did it. And it was really a good feeling walking away, knowing that we had achieved the success that we wanted to in pulling it all together.
This was the March on Washington is something that the First National call for went out from Harvey Milk on Gay Freedom Day in 1978. So this was some 16 months later. Harvey Milk is dead, and there was the club with the banner.
Yeah, Harvey Milk was there. Harvey Milk was there in the minds of the people. Harvey Milk was there in the speeches. Many, many people mentioned Harvey Milk, either in passing or as the subject of their talks to the group. And, you know, I was talking to Cleve Jones, and we really felt that Harvey was there, and we weren't worried that, you know, that he wasn't. We knew he was around.
You mentioned speakers. Were these the San Francisco speakers or speakers from other parts of the country?
Oh, all over the country. All over the country. Harvey Milk was a symbol, and he's a martyr, and people are referred to Harvey Milk on various levels. A black man that spoke very early in the day referred to Harvey Milk as our Martin Luther King, and then there were other quotes from Harvey, but it was very evident that the people knew that we were achieving something that Harvey Milk very desperately wanted to see happen in this country, and that's to come together and to show a force. And so they relied on those strengths, the strengths of Harvey Milk.
So you think that Harvey has become a national symbol rather than just a local one?
Oh, definitely. People walking on the street, Cleve and I were left a meeting talking about 1980 politics, and he said something about Harvey, and this man stopped us and said, "Where are you from?" And we said, "San Francisco," and he goes, "Oh, do you mean people who come from San Francisco can refer to him just as Harvey?" And, you know, I looked at Cleve and he looked at me, and it told us, you know, people have an entirely different perception of who and what Harvey Milk. They have put him in a place of honor, and of course we do too, but we think of it in a different level because we knew him. And sometimes I have to have that myself reminded of how people perceive San Francisco and what goes on here and our personalities.
A lot of the speakers were from San Francisco, though. One of them was Supervisor Harry Britt.
Right.
Who else? What did Harry say?
Harry spoke about what I have just been mentioning, the fact that this was Harvey's idea, it was Harvey's call, and we are here. And Harry mentioned the appropriateness of showing to the nation that we do exist. And I think he used the term coming home, and to come home to our nation's capital and say, "We are here. Behold us. Look at us as we are." And that was, I think, the tone of Harry's discussion or speech.
Any other speeches stand out in your memory?
I don't know that if it's one speech, but a collection of all of the various people who wanted to express their feelings that, yes, you were doing something right. And I'm not so much talking about other gay speakers as much as I'm talking about the non-gay people, you know, the mother and father of a gay son, or the gay man that was fighting for custody of the rights to his children. You know, all day we saw varying degrees of gayness, people who have fully accepted it, people who – one man had just come out within the last few months. And I think I was impressed by the variety, the Chicanos, the American Indian, who they call the first gay American, were the American Indians. And the whole day was – the tone was a very positive tone that we can achieve if we pull it all together. And I think that the day as a whole is impressive rather than individual speakers.
We've been talking to John Joyner about the National March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights. Next, Pat Parker reads her poem, For Straight Folks.
This last poem I will dedicate to our good sister Anita. It's called For the Straight Folks Who Don't Mind Gays But Wish They Weren't So Blatant. You know, some people got a lot of nerve. Sometimes I don't believe the things I see and hear. Have you met the woman who's shocked by two women kissing and in the same breath tells you that she's pregnant? But gays shouldn't be blatant. Or this straight couple sits next to you in a movie and you can't hear the dialogue because of the sound effects. But gays shouldn't be blatant. And the woman in your office spends your whole lunch hour talking about her new bikini drawers and how much her husband likes them. But gays shouldn't be blatant. Or the hip chick in your class rattling a mile a minute while you're trying to get stoned in a john about the camping trip she took with her musician boyfriend. But gays shouldn't be blatant. You go in a public bathroom, and all over the walls, there's John loves Mary, Janice digs Richard, Pepe loves Dolores, etc. But gays shouldn't be blatant. Or you go to an amusement park, and there's a tunnel of love, and pictures of straights painted on the front, and grinning couples coming in and out. But gays shouldn't be blatant. Fact is, blatant heterosexuals are all over the place. Supermarkets, movies, at work, in church, in books, on television, every day and night, every place, even in gay bars. And they want gay men and women to go hide in the closets. So to you straight folks, I say, sure, I'll go, if you go too. But I'm polite, so after you. Thank you.
And our next guest this morning is Les Morgan, who's the coordinator of the gay recruitment drive for the San Francisco Police Force. Good morning, Les.
Good morning, Randy.
Your position as coordinator of gay recruitment isn't really an official one. It's something you're doing on behalf of the community?
That's right. The program is called the Gay Outreach Program, and it's a volunteer community group of lesbians and gay men that works with the police department and the civil service department to promote recruitment of lesbians and gays, but it is actually not funded by the city. It's just a community group.
And you've been doing this for how long now?
Since October of 1978. We've just completed our first year of recruitment.
And how did that go? Wasn't there some problem with the number of gay people, the number of people that the police actually are going to take from that list?
Well, the city's recruitment drive as a whole was really a catastrophe. The conclusion of the whole year-long process was that the federal judge ruled that it had been so defectively done that he was going to just throw it all out and order a very small number of people to be hired and have recruitment begin again immediately, which is why right now we're actually back to recruitment. However, of the relatively small number of people that would be hired, that's only 200 officers, less one, or 199 officers, we have done quite well among that group.
With about how many people?
Well, our outcome success will depend on how you count it. But under the most conservative counting model, we have slightly over 8% of the hires that will be affected between now and May of 1980.
So obviously we don't know about people who are closeted gays going through the application process, or even if they're generally out of the closet but not
just, in contact with
just
us.
Not in, right.
That's right.
People who may be out of the closet but decided not to expressly say they were gay for purposes of the police application process.
Well, there is no way to declare your sexual orientation in the application process. There's no questions on the form about it. It's not supposed to be covered in the background investigation. So the only way that we would be able to count the number of lesbians and gay men would be if they had gotten in touch with our program and requested to be placed on a special mailing list to receive information about workshops and training events. So when we come up with a figure of 8% of the hires, that's really a floor on the total number of hires that will be affected. It's based only on people who are active with our program. And we do know of a substantial number of others who have gone through the process without choosing to get in touch with us, either because they didn't know we were there or because they preferred not to have involvement with us.
So what would be both a conservative estimate and probably a slightly higher and more realistic estimate of the number of upfront gay and lesbian police officers that the San Francisco Department would hire by next year? Not in percentage, but in actual numbers of officers on the street.
Well, the number of persons who are actually on our list would be 16 within the top 190 hires which will be affected, and that's a fairly hard figure. Now, the question of what it means to be upfront is a very complicated one. Most of the people who are going through our program, their reason for doing it is not because they're trying to politicize the police department or make a big national issue out of this. They're looking for employment in what they view as a serious and important occupation where they think they can do a good job. So in many cases, although they are almost completely planning to be open with their coworkers, they're very averse of about, say, media attention, which I think is very realistic. If you become a media personality, which would be very easy to have happen if you were the first openly gay officer in the United States, it could seriously interfere with your ability to do the job.
You mean to say that in no other departments in the country, let alone San Francisco, there are not openly gay police officers?
That's right. There are no openly gay police officers anywhere in the United States.
We do have openly gay sheriff's deputies in San Francisco, though.
That's correct. In 1976, I supervised an outreach program to try and recruit lesbians and gay men for the sheriff's department. Now, the sheriff's department in San Francisco has no patrol authority. That is, it does not go out and arrest people. And its primary authority has to do with running the jails and court-associated functions. And there are now over a dozen upfront gay deputy sheriffs, including two sergeants, I might add.
But as far as you know, then, there are no gay sheriff's deputies in jurisdictions that where the sheriffs do have law enforcement.
That's right. San Francisco is the only city in the country to have openly gay persons in law enforcement, and that's within the San Francisco Sheriff's Department. Now, the reason for that is that most other law enforcement agencies, all other law enforcement agencies in the country, with one or two exceptions which are recently changing their political line but haven't really done anything about it yet, say that you can't be in their department if you're gay. And they will go through extremely detailed background investigations to find out the sexual tastes of people who are applying for that department. If what you like to do in bed doesn't correspond with what the chief enjoys, you can't have the job.
Or which what is, the chief says he enjoys.
Or what the chief says he enjoys. So there's some very, very peculiar screening practices, really very questionable. The International Association of Chiefs of Police, which is the largest management-level organization for police administrators, has a flat no-hire policy on the basis of sexuality. And interestingly, the argument that the head of the IACP makes is that the reason why you shouldn't hire gays is because the police department should be reflective of the community it serves. And until such time as the community is accepting of homosexuality, you should refuse to hire gay cops. So obviously, you know, what would you do? Does that mean you can't have black officers in the South? Or does that mean you can't have women officers just about anywhere?
One of the departments that has changed its policy but hasn't done anything in reality you're referring to, one of those is San Diego, I believe.
That's right.
What are the other ones?
Portland is the other one that has gotten a great deal of press. The chief in Portland recently indicated that he would not discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. That was widely misinterpreted in the press as him about to mount a recruitment drive, which he subsequently indicated he had no intention of doing. In Los Angeles also, Daryl Gates, of all people, has indicated that he would not discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. That's Ed Davis's former department. Davis is no longer the chief down there.
Well, getting back to square one, why would gay people be seeking careers in law enforcement anyway, whether in the police department or the sheriff's department? I mean, I think for many gay people, police are still regarded as the enemy, them, the man, the people who come in and bust up the bars or hassle you on the streets, or if you report that you've been beaten up and hassled for being gay, they'll, even if you point out the victims, they might let the victims go and hassle you or even bust you. I mean, why gay police officers?
For all of the reasons that you just mentioned, that's the reason why we so desperately need to get lesbians and gay men into that force. Because until such time as the force is really representative of the whole community, and that means all of the citizens in this city, it's going to not really adequately enforce laws. It's not going to enforce laws in a fair manner. And I don't believe that it is possible for a police department to adequately serve lesbians and gay men unless it has lesbians and gay men on the force as officers. Now, police work is tremendously important. It's not going to go away. It is unthinkable to imagine the United States without police forces. Now, the question then becomes, what are you going to do about that? A philosophy of despair would say, in the past, many departments have been very excessive in brutality and in inappropriate acts, and therefore it's hopeless. You can't possibly impact on it. Well, I think that whole philosophy, which is a philosophy of despair and hopelessness, is not the right way to approach social problems of any kind. I believe that the department can be changed and that it can be made to reflect the community, and that's the reason why I'm involved with this. And if you look at the experience with the sheriff's department, that model has been borne out. Because with the introduction of lesbians and gay men as deputy sheriffs, you find that gay prisoners in the jails are now treated with much more empathy than they were prior to the introduction of those kinds of personnel.
But the sheriff's department in San Francisco is mainly a kind of custodial or caretaking institution, where given the fact that the police have decided to make an arrest, and if after several days the district attorney or judges haven't dropped the case, the people in the sheriff's department don't really have large numbers of day-to-day, minute-to-minute discretionary decisions to make about who should be arrested and who should not. And given that there are certain people in their care, it should then follow from just a sense of humanity that you treat the people as well as they can be under the limitations of having to confine them and under the limitations of a budget. But a police officer has to decide all the time what behavior can be tolerated and what not and so forth. And even though we talk about rational enforcement of the laws, there are just lots of instances in which a police officer decides, well, I'll warn the person or I'll wink at this behavior, figuratively or literally. And won't this put gay people in the position of having to make arrests for things, you know, laws maybe that they don't believe in, or having to, I don't know. I mean, it just seems seems awfully strange. And we're not going to get the gay police officers aren't necessarily going to get assigned to a gay neighborhood anyway, or to a lesbian neighborhood if there are lesbian neighborhoods. Okay.
There are at least three things I'd like to respond to in that. The first thing is the presumption that within the sheriff's jurisdiction, there are no discretionary elements. Being in jail, it can be a tremendously brutalizing and dehumanizing experience for people. People get raped every night in the San Francisco County jail systems. At any given time, you have about 1,000 people under lock and key in the city and county of San Francisco. And it turns out that prior to Sheriff Hengisto's administration, gay inmates were brutalized, absolutely brutalized and victimized within that jail system in unspeakable ways. I was the director of the Management Improvement Program in the Sheriff's Department for 3.5 years, and I know a great deal about the mechanics of running that facility. And it is incorrect to assert that the presence of lesbian and gay deputies in that facility hasn't had a beneficial impact.
No, I wasn't suggesting that. What I was suggesting was that for a gay person to work in the jail is, in fact, a place where obviously they can emphasize and humanize what the institution has to do and do it in a better fashion and in a more humane fashion, but that the sheriff's department isn't in the process of introducing people into the criminal justice system.
Right.
It's not the one that puts people in trouble with the law, as it were. It takes care of them once they are in trouble with the law.
Right. It's a post-arrest facility.
The police officers have to make the decision about who's going to get in trouble with the law.
That's my second point,
okay,
which is the exercise of discretion, which is an extremely important part of police work. Police officers, as they're going about their business, see so many things that could be violations of the law, that if they actually arrested everybody that they see committing a crime, they would have no time to do anything else, quite frankly. So the exercise of discretion is one of the key issues in police work. Now, that's the reason why we need lesbians and gay men as officers. Because let's say you do have a situation where there is a marginal issue going on. There is perhaps no real violation of the law taking place. But if some officer who is homophobic and wants to cause trouble for gay people, wants to create problems, he or she could very easily abuse that discretionary authority and go in there and make an arrest where no arrest was justified. Now, I think that having a gay officer on the force will have two effects. The first would be that, of course, in the particular cases where that officer makes the observation, there would not be an arrest unless there really was a genuine violation of law going on. The second thing is that the presence of gay officers on the force in peer relationships with other officers will have a tremendous educational effect on the other officers and will cause them to have to deal with their own homophobia in a very direct manner that I think will translate into a change in their own behavior. And the third point has to do with the issue of enforcing unpopular laws. You raise the case, what if a gay officer saw a crime being committed? Let's take drug laws, for example, smoking marijuana in public or something along those lines. That's a very, very common arrest in many areas of San Francisco, such as the Castro area and the Polk Street area. Now, what if an officer sees that? Well, there's no question but that if a law is being violated, the officer, regardless of their race or their color or their sexual orientation, has to follow the prevailing departmental guidelines regarding arrest practices. I don't see any reason to be embarrassed about that. That's reality. You cannot, if you reduce it to individuals making choices about what laws to enforce, then it's anarchy. That goes beyond the issue of discretionary exercise of authority to deciding which laws you're going to enforce and which ones you aren't. Incidentally, this issue is raised all the time with other kinds of minorities. For example, when blacks were first coming into the department, it was alleged that that would be very bad because blacks wouldn't ever arrest blacks. That, of course, is not the case. Latins will arrest Latins, and gays are going to have to arrest gays. It's as simple as that. But there will be no effort within the San Francisco department to specifically assign gay officers to gay districts. Just as with other minorities, they will receive general patrol duties over all of the city, not just certain gay ghettos.
This is The Gay Life on KSAN. We're speaking to Les Morgan, who's with the Gay Outreach Program of the current San Francisco Police Department's recruitment efforts. Les, you mentioned the peer involvement of a gay officer with a non-gay officer and how that'll have an educational effect. If we're talking about in this current class of maybe 20 gay upfront gay and lesbian officers on a force that at full strength is close to 1,800 or maybe higher than that, what kind of – are there other efforts to do in-service training for police training? And what's included in the current curriculum at the police academy?
The current police academy curriculum has just been revised as a result of a lengthy committee effort on the part of a number of people in the gay community, and it is including much more extensive coverage on the gay community orientation than previously. The in-service training for officers does include things like field tours. They go out into gay bars in order to see what the community is like, and the gay community is presented in the same place in the curriculum as other minority communities, such as the black community, the Latin community, and so forth. Interestingly, this academy has also got is treating white working class as a minority group, and the academy classes are going to be going out visiting white working class bars, just as they're going out and visiting gay bars and black bars and things like that.
Well, if in fact this the upcoming class is going to be about half minorities and 20% women, it would seem that there may be some need.
I think it's a valid point. In many cases, the white working class lifestyle is a deviant lifestyle for San Francisco. And I think that people like that deserve just as much consideration as anybody else.
Is anything like this going on in other Bay Area cities, either in terms of in-service training for existing police or in terms of recruitment efforts for the police force? It seems to me that a city like Berkeley might be ready for it, and somewhere down the line, maybe Oakland.
There are no other recruitment programs at all in existence anywhere in the United States. This is it. Now, in terms of training, many departments in major urban areas do have some sort of a curriculum component which is devoted to the gay community, but it tends to vary in quality tremendously. But San Francisco really, at this point, is the only city that is doing things in this depth.
Will the next, this first recruit class that includes some number of gay people, will it graduate from the academy before or after January 8th? Will Chief Gaines see his first openly gay recruits come through before he has to leave, or will that desire of his and 2 or 3 year intention be frustrated by calendar?
It's going to be a photo finish, I think, because the first police academy starts on November 13th. And the way the academy works is that they're going to be running batches of 40 people through at a time. And they'll start a new academy cycle every 6 weeks. So the first batch of 40 will be coming out right about when Gain will be leaving office. And there will be at least three of our candidates in that first academy class.
And you're also working now on the next cycle of recruitment, where the city is going to have to recruit a total of how many in the next cycle?
The city hasn't set specific numerical goals. It is moving toward an effort which is going to be much more focused in recruitment. Before, they pushed general recruitment in the general media quite a bit and wound up with 7,400 applicants and only hired 199 of them. That was perceived by everybody to be excessive in terms of the ratio of recruits to hires. So this time they're going to have a more focused effort. And our program is now actively trying to get in touch with anyone in the community who would like information about how to file. People who would like information about filing for the department can call me, Les Morgan, at 775-1000.
That's 775-1000.
And what happens if you give me a call is that I can add you to the confidential mailing list for the gay recruitment program.
So that is the police department that's conducting the formal part of the enlistment and enrollment won't, in fact, know that you are being aided by the gay recruitment drive. It's completely
confidential. That's right. It's completely confidential. And the hiring process is controlled by the Civil Service Department, not by the police directly. And what our program does is on a completely volunteer basis, we are not a part of the police or civil service departments. We can log you onto a confidential mailing list and then provide you with information about workshops and support groups which will address the specific concerns, just like we've been talking about today, about why would gays really want to have this kind of a job and could they survive once they're in the department.
So you also conduct the workshops and training groups?
Right. We have our workshop program offers a workshop every 4 to 6 weeks, and that covers every possible aspect of the application process. We go over the how to do it, how to apply, what the background investigations are like, training for the examinations, and just about everything else. And the workshops are timed to coincide with the phases of the recruitment cycle.
Have the people who were involved in the first cycle found the workshops particularly useful? Or
many of them say that the most helpful thing out of the whole program has been the opportunity to get together with other applicants and talk about their concerns about filing.
Because mutual support.
Mutual support, exactly. And among the candidates who are now going into the department, it's going to be a very stressful situation for them entering the academy. There's a lot of homophobia in the department, and there's no way that we can cover that up or make light of it. So the problem is to address it straight on and say, yes, it's a homophobic environment. How can we survive within that environment? And the way you survive is by not trying to go it alone, trying to come in with some support.
So you expect that these mutual support groups will continue into academy classes and perhaps even further into the recruit's entire life in the police department, entire career?
Well, we certainly intend to continue offering the workshops over the next 6 months to a year, because we know that we are going to be having really our very first candidates going in, and we want very much to give them every possible chance to succeed. Now, whether that grows into some sort of an organization of gay police officers would be something they would have to decide at that time. We're not pushing for creation of a unit like that. All we're trying to do right now is to say we're trying to give a structure in which people can get together and receive accurate information about what's going on.
Okay. This has been a very enlightening and interesting interview. We've covered a whole variety of police and sheriff-type issues. Thank you very much for being our guest on The Gay Life this morning, Les Morgan. Do you have any parting shots of anything that you've been meaning to say and forgot before?
Well, I think I would just reiterate the philosophy of that the police work is tremendously important work. It's too important for lesbians and gay men to leave it to heterosexuals. We've got to have a piece of that action. And if you would like a piece of that action, who are listening to this program, please give me a call at 775-1000.
Okay. Thank you, Les Morgan. This is The Gay Life on KSAN San Francisco. Our next guest on The Gay Life on KSAN is Roland Scambari. Good morning, Roland.
Hi.
Roland is an old associate of mine from a publication that we worked on last year, but this year Roland's working on a new one called Coming Up, which is a calendar. How did the idea come about for this?
Well, Bill Hartman and I were sitting in the Village Deli on Castro Street one night just sort of talking, and we realized when we looked over and saw all these free publications that they had in there available for people that there really wasn't a calendar of events available for the Bay Area's gay community, and we thought, why not have one? So we decided to do it, and Coming Up is what it's called.
And it'll be coming out monthly?
That's right. The first issue is out. It's the October, Coming Up October. The next issue is coming up November, and it'll be out about October 26th.
Where is it available?
All over the city and in the East Bay, at most of gay bars and restaurants, at women's bookstores, at the women's bars, at places like Amelia's and Artemis Society. Just everywhere that gay people go in the city, it's available.
And that includes both gay men and lesbians in this case, since
that's
the
right.
Slant of most of the other throwaway gay publications is towards the male community.
Right. We want the publication to be used by women as well as men, and there are women contributors, and we're trying to keep that balance.
When you say contributors, there's more to the publication, as I look at it, than just the calendar. There are a couple of feature articles. And
well, what we're trying to do, it's very simple. Perhaps it's best to describe it. It's four pages. The two inside pages are the calendar.
I know. It's up on the wall next to the refrigerator in my kitchen.
Great. The two outside pages are – there's a front page and a back page. The front page has our logo on it, and it also will have each month a theme article that's themed to the month. Like in October, the article is about Halloween, and it's by Arthur Evans, and
who was a guest on the Gay Life several months ago.
Aha. And it talks about the gay aspects of that holiday. For November, we're not sure exactly what the theme article will be. We haven't been able to figure that out yet, but there will be one. In December, we're going to have an article written by Celeste Nubro, who was the co-chair of the Gay Freedom Day Parade this past year. It will be about the winter solstice and the coming holidays in December. And then in January, we're going to have an article by Randy Alfred.
The topic of which hasn't been decided yet.
Right, but it'll be funny.
Yes, it'll be frivolous. If I can't come up with any fresh, something freshly frivolous, I will look in my frivolity file under F. The purpose of it is that none of the existing publications actually have a calendar where you can look and see, oh, today's Monday the 22nd. What am I going to do today if I want to go and be somewhere in a gay environment or if something that's of political importance to gay people? How are you financing it, though? I mean, newsprint is expensive.
Well, Bill and I borrowed some money, and we used some of our limited funds that we ourselves had, and we're counting on advertising to pay for it as it gets better known. The first issue had a couple of paid ads, and the rest of them we ran gratis just to show what ads would look like. The November issue is going to have much more paid advertising. We did a mailing to advertisers, and I've been spending this past week and this week calling prospective advertisers and seeing if they will take advertising. Once I think the calendar is established and people know that it's going to be there every month, I think the advertising will come.
If people want to get a listing in Coming Up, they have to know several things. They have to know the deadline. They have to know where to send it and to whom. And it seems they should also know what general criteria you have for what you will list and what you won't list. So why don't we start with what it is you do want to list?
We want to list events that that are going to be of interest to our readers, obviously. And that would be any kind of special events, say, going on in the gay bars. A lot of the bars have special nights for different things, or they have guests who come in and perform. We want to list parties. We want to list dances. We want to list celebrations. We want to list political demonstrations that are of particular interest to the gay community. We want to list things that are on radio or television. For instance, if you have listings for the Gay Life, we'd like those to be in there. Anything and everything that could be of interest to gay people, we want to list. We want to try to be as comprehensive as possible and to list everything that we possibly can. I think after a while, we'll probably have more listings than we can use, and then we'll probably have to start using some editorial discretion on what we list and what we don't list. But at this point, almost anything that is of interest to us as people, we would list.
Do you have any things that you wouldn't list that wouldn't be worth people's while to send in? Any guidelines, say, on sexism or racism or any of the other isms?
Yes, all the isms go for us. We want to be clear about that. If some event is obviously exploitive of people, we don't want to list it.
Okay. And what are the deadlines for any given month's issue? It's getting time, by the way, for people to pen and pencil time here on the Gay Life.
The deadline is the 20th of the month preceding the month of publication. So, for instance, for this coming issue, which is the November issue, the deadline
has just passed.
And people should mail their listings. Okay. We don't take any listings over the telephone. I want that understood. Should mail their listings to Coming Up, 150 Central Avenue, San Francisco, 94117.
That's 150 Central Avenue, San Francisco, 94117. To Coming Up. Should they mark it to anyone's attention?
No. It'll get to – there are only two of us, so it'll get to the proper person.
Is there anything else? I should point out before we conclude this interview that those of you who find Roland's voice familiar on the radio have probably heard him in years past and even recently on KPFA's Fruit Punch, found slightly to the left of KSAN, which is still on Wednesday nights at 10 o'clock.
Yes. I'm no longer in the Fruit Punch Collective.
But you participated in the coverage of the March on Washington, I believe.
Right. I went to the station, and I participated in that. I asked people to give money to the station at the time because KPFA was in the midst of its money-raising marathon, as it is every fall.
Okay. Speaking for Coming Up, the gay community's latest and freshest and really well-designed calendar has been Roland Scambari. Thank you, Roland, for coming and visiting us on The Gay Life this morning.
Well, she's a hard-driving lover, soon to recover from all the tears and woes. Oh, she never was a shower, but soon she'll discover that people mostly come and go, mostly go. And she knows I never want another lover like no other. Everybody's baby, and all I get is baby. She's about to drive me wild. Oh, child, she can say she's lost, but it's me who pays the cost. I think it's gonna cramp my style, gonna cramp my style, but I. sun so bare. And if I grow old, I can block out the cold with good times that I once had. So don't be sad, but I'll never want another.
It was Teresa Troll with I Hope She'll See on Olivia Records. Has been all of our music and poetry this morning. That about wraps it up for the Gay Life this morning. Our guests have been Les Morgan, the coordinator of the Gay Community Police Outreach for the police recruitment, Roland Scambari of Coming Up, a new calendar, and John Joyner of the Harvey Milk Gay Democratic Club and Alice B. Toklas Memorial Democratic Club. The Gay Life is engineered by Rick Sadel and produced by me, Randy Alfred. I also write a column, Taking Sides, for The Sentinel, which is available in gay neighborhoods throughout San Francisco. If you're listening on Sunday morning, this show will be repeated late Monday night at 1 a.m. So please tell a friend about The Gay Life on KSAN San Francisco.